giant, even though it had contributed mightily to its presidential campaign coffers. Democrats should be reminded from time to time that they don't have a stellar record of egalitarianism themselves. Indeed, if you look at history, you'll see that the Democrats have a shameful record of opening their big tent to racist and segregationists. Rob Byrd, their most senior member of the U.S. Senate, a man revered among his Democratic colleagues in the media as the conscience of the Senate, who chairs the enormously powerful Appropriations Committee, was once a member himself of the Ku Klux Klan. Yes, Byrd quit. Yes, he says he regrets it. But then Byrd also went on to fight furiously against the 1964 Civil Rights Act. He even filibustered against the bill for nearly 14 hours. And Republicans have a better record on race than they are often given credit for. When former Klan leader David Duke tried to run for governor in Louisiana and then for president as a Republican, the GOP fought him tooth and nail. Former President Ronald Reagan, then President George Bush, his son George W. Bush, and other Republican leaders vigorously denounced Duke and actively worked against him. Reagan cut radio ads supporting Duke's Republican opponent in 1989. W. personally traveled to Louisiana to denounce Duke and support his opponent. Conservatives took their stand against racism and the Klan and for the Civil Rights Act of 1964, compared with only 63% of Democrats. In the Senate, 82% of Republicans supported the legislation, the Civil Rights Act, compared with only 69% of Democrats. Al Gore's father, then a Democratic senator from Tennessee, not only voted against the Civil Rights Act of 1964, he helped lead a filibuster of segregationist Southerners against it. Also voting against it was Senator J. William Fulbright, a Democrat from Arkansas, for whom Bill Clinton interned and who was one of Clinton's political mentors. In addition to legislation aimed at enforcing equal rights, conservative Republicans have advocated policies that promote opportunity and prosperity for all Americans. It was the Reagan tax cuts and pro-growth economic program that led to an explosion of new wealth creation for Black and Hispanic Americans. From 1982 to 1987, the number of Black-owned business firms increased by nearly 38%, about triple the overall business growth rate during that period, noted then Housing and Urban Development Secretary Jack Kemp at the 10-year anniversary of the signing of the tax cut bill that he helped author. Hispanic-owned businesses soared by 81%. The number of Black families earning $50,000 a year doubled during the 1980s, which is a stunning accomplishment. Black Enterprise magazine concurred. It took issue with some of the Reagan-Bush administration policies, but it also agreed that the decade of the 1980s, quote, was characterized by vigorous growth in the size and diversity of the nation's largest Black-owned companies. Total sales more than tripled from $2.3 billion to nearly $8 billion. Average sales per company rose to $45 million during the decade, and Black-owned companies with sales exceeding $20 million became increasingly common beginning in 1984. By 1985, there were some 350,000 Black-owned businesses in America, up dramatically from just 50,000 in 1968. For the last several decades, conservatives have been fighting for educational freedom, choice, and opportunity in our inner cities, in places like Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Cleveland, Ohio, and elsewhere, so that all children, regardless of race, color, or ethnic background, have a chance to receive a quality education. It is also conservatives who have championed enterprise zones, which are intended to significantly reduce the tax and regulatory burdens on businesses that locate in economically poor areas, or as an inducement for existing businesses to remain, expand, and employ more people who live there. And consider this, it was Ronald Reagan who made Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a national holiday. It was Reagan who extended the Voting Rights Act for an unprecedented 25 years, and it was Reagan who appointed Colin Powell the first African-American National Security Advisor. Incidentally, it was also Reagan who appointed the first woman to the U.S. Supreme Court. More recently, among his first acts as president, George W. Bush appointed Condoleezza Rice, the first African-American woman to serve as National Security Advisor, and he appointed Powell as the first African-American Secretary of State. The party of Abraham Lincoln has a strong record of inclusion and of supporting policies that are beneficial to minorities and to all Americans. Republicans should proudly and confidently invoke this record as we continue to reach out to African-Americans and other minorities just as George W. Bush has done. There is no reason that an overwhelming majority of African Americans and other minorities should continue to identify with the Democratic Party. The Democrats may be more shameless in trying to craft messages that minority interest focus groups want to hear, but the principles and policies of the Republican Party are the only ones that will empower them to lay claim to the American dream. Heading into the 1996 elections, White House Press Secretary Mike McCurry used familiar scare tactics by warning that conservative Republicans want to see the Medicare program just die and go away. And that's probably what they'd like to see happen to seniors, too, if you think about it, unquote. Representative Pat Williams, the Montana Democrat, alleged that Republicans are gutting Medicare. Today, Medicare, tomorrow, Social Security, programs they have always opposed and oppose today. Representative Ed Markey, the Massachusetts Democrat, warned the GOP, the grand old party, should now be thought of as the get old people party. And Representative John Dingell, a Michigan Democrat, announced that when it came to a Republican Medicare reform plan, quote, there is only one reason this bill is required, to finance tax cuts for the rich. Gearing up for the 2000 elections, Vice President Al Gore charged, quote, I hear Republicans talking about fundamentally changing Social Security and Medicare, but I'll be damned if I'm going to see Social Security and Medicare destroyed or unraveled or unwound. And during the campaign for the 2002 elections, Dick Gephardt warned that, quote, the Republican Party has always opposed Social Security and Medicare, and these latest scare tactics are part of a 66-year drive to gut Social Security and let people fend for themselves at age 65. But facts are facts. No seniors have been harmed because of the contract with America and conservative control of Congress for the past 8 years. Medicare has not been destroyed because of reforms President Clinton and conservative Republicans agreed to in the Balanced Budget Act of 1997. Moreover, no seniors will be wiped out by the expanded choices that would result if Congress passes the comprehensive Medicare reforms proposed by Senator John Breaux, a moderate Louisiana Democrat, and Senator Bill Frist, a Tennessee Republican and former heart surgeon. President Bush is investing hundreds of billions of dollars more towards strengthening Medicare over the next decade, above and beyond the already planned annual increases. He proposes fully protecting the Social Security benefits of current and imminent retirees while giving young people the choice to invest a small percentage of their payroll taxes into their own personal retirement account if they so choose. He's also empaneled a number of experts led by former Senator Moynihan to advise him on Social Security reform. The liberals, by contrast, propose no serious reforms for Social Security. In fact, their only solution is to continue subsidizing it out of general revenue instead of working to make it self-sustaining through partial privatization. Right now, American taxpayers face a nearly $20 trillion unfunded Social Security liability. Although today we have a large Social Security surplus, when baby boomers start retiring, Washington is going to start paying out more in benefits than it receives in payroll taxes. Around the year 2020, the Social Security deficit alone will be around $100 billion and will approach $300 billion by the year 2037. If we do nothing to improve the current system, we will eventually face three terrible options. One, cut benefits to the bone, severely harming low-income seniors and particularly women whose benefits are already pathetically meager and who unfortunately have been conditioned to be dependent on these funds for their retirement. Two, radically increase payroll tax rates, severely harming young families by dramatically increasing rates from 12.4% today to upwards of 18% or more, meaning a family earning $30,000 a year and currently paying $3,720 a year in Social Security taxes could be forced to pay an additional $1,860 a year. And three, a combination of severe benefit cuts and confiscatory tax increases. Worse, even if Washington found another $20 trillion to pump into the existing system, it would still be a bad deal for Americans. Most of us working today receive less than 2% rate of return on the money that we put into Social Security. Much better rates of return are available from mutual funds and bonds or even bank certificates of deposit, CDs, which offer a fixed rate of return and thus involve a negligible risk to the consumer. any privatized monies upon death could be passed on to a spouse or your children or your grandchildren or a favorite charity. Some 20 countries around the world give their workers the freedom to use personal retirement accounts to create real retirement security and personal wealth, and we should too. In fact, a similar system is already at work right here in America, and it's had remarkable results. In the late 1970s, local officials in three counties in Texas, including Galveston, wanted to improve the financial security of their employees and improve their rate of return. They began working with local banking officials and developed a retirement plan for government workers that would allow them to opt out of Social Security, which they did. Now, the funds would be professionally and conservatively managed. Furthermore, as one of the architects of the plan, Judge Ray Holbrook, testified before the Social Security Reform Commission, the key feature of the plan was that it would use no stock market investments, only commercial banking products, annuities, and bonds that provide guaranteed fixed interest rates and no risk. The program was instituted over strident liberal opposition, and 20 years later, the results are in, and they are very impressive. The government workers are getting an average annual rate of return between 7 and 8% on their money. They are accruing real wealth at a fairly rapid clip. They have a disability insurance that pays up to 60% of a worker's salary, up to $5,000 a month, if something terrible happens to them. And they also have life insurance that pays a worker's widow and family three times that worker's annual salary, up to $150,000. Now, this matters to real people, says Judge Holbrook. A county commissioner, colleague friend of mine, passed away not long ago. His widow was quite young, about 40. From Social Security, she received a lump sum survivorship benefit of $255. Not per month, not per year. That was it, $255. What did she receive from our alternative plan? She received a lump sum survivorship benefit of $150,000. Plus, she's entitled to a reserve account of $125,000 available at any time she wants to draw it down. So from Social Security, this widow received $255. From our plan, she received more than $250,000. This is the miracle of freedom. When you give people the freedom to make choices for themselves and don't force them into a one-size-fits-all system run by Washington, you'll be amazed at the results. I know personal retirement accounts can work because I have one, says Judge Holbrook. I know a commission can design a better system because I was part of one. I know it's possible to build public support for bold reform because I did it. I know it's possible to change the heart of a skeptic because I was one. What a great example of American free enterprise and optimism Judge Holbrook and his Galveston project are. Now, let that be a lesson not only to liberals, but also to fellow conservatives who sometimes fear that we'll never be able to cut through the superheated rhetoric to get our message out. For even as I write this, there are some Republicans in Capitol Hill pressing for a vote that would put the GOP on record as being against honest, forward-looking Social Security reform that would protect seniors and give young people more freedom to save for their own futures. Unfortunately, but not surprisingly, they're being spooked by liberal fear-mongering. But they shouldn't be. Galveston should serve as a model for Social Security reform, just as conservative-sponsored welfare reform was the right thing to do and made life better for the neediest of Americans. So also conservative-sponsored Social Security reform would help Americans shore up their retirement security and give them more control over their own financial destiny. This is not to say that formidable political obstacles don't stand in the way of reform. Sadly, it's clear that the left would rather have a political issue than to participate in protecting and saving the Social Security system. Even some Democrats have painfully acknowledged their party's ploy. I would urge my fellow Democrats to lower the rhetoric and stop the kill the messenger strategy, said Robert Johnson, CEO of Black Entertainment Television and a member of President Bush's Social Security Commission. Fidel Vargas, a Democrat and investment strategist, also a member of President Bush's team of Social Security advisors, echoed Johnson's sentiment. I am not here to gut Social Security, he said. I am here to strengthen it. These statements are encouraging for those who insist that reform is a hopeless cause. But Republicans need to push for reform with greater urgency before the system goes broke so millions of retirees can have meaningful Social Security. Knowing all the cards liberals will try to play is enormously helpful, but knowing how best to respond and to play the cards in their own hand is absolutely essential. For this, we must look to three modern conservative leaders who offer an extraordinary model of how to move our ideas from vision to victory in the 21st century: Ronald Reagan, Newt Gingrich, and George W. Bush. Each has been a strong leader. Each has been a man of ideas. Each faced down withering attacks from the left. One man's ideas triumphed, and he will go down in history as a great and beloved president. The second man's ideas triumphed, although history will show that he paid a severe career-ending price. And the third man is impressing the nation and the world as a phenomenal wartime president, and history is still waiting to judge him. Reagan, I believe, is our greatest modern American president and one of the most important presidents of all time. Ever since Reagan emerged onto the national stage during the Goldwater campaign in 1964, liberals sought to destroy him, his ideas, his character, for they understood right from the beginning the threat that he posed to them and their agenda. They knew from the beginning of his political career that Reagan had been a Democrat, voted for FDR, initially supported the New Deal, worked in Hollywood, and not only served in a labor union, but led one. They knew all too well that Ronald Reagan understood the liberal mindset and ultimately had rejected it. He began speaking out. He began engaging in the political process. He began playing to win, and liberals knew it and did everything they could to stop him. President Carter called Reagan's approach to foreign policy extremely dangerous. He called Reagan himself dangerous and radical. Carter's aides called Reagan dumb, trigger-happy, a mad bomber. Columnist Tom Wicker of the New York Times asked, quote, "Do you really want Ronald Reagan with his finger on the button?" Columnist Mary McGorry of the Washington Post described Reagan as a shallow nuclear cowboy. Walter Mondale described Reagan's conservative ideas as dangerously destabilizing. Gary Hart worried that such ideas could lead us to World War III. On and on it went, liberals grasped for any fear-mongering charge and disparaging label available to defeat Mr. Conservative, his philosophy, and approach to government. But they could not have been more wrong. They underestimated not only the Gipper, but the good judgment of the American people, who weren't buying any of it. Ronald Reagan had a vision of where he believed America must go. He set out to defeat, not just contain, the Soviet Union and global communism. He set out to rebuild the American military and reinvigorate the country's sense of patriotism and self-confidence. He set out to cut taxes, unleash the smothered spirit of entrepreneurship and innovation, and revive the stalled American economy, or as he put it, to get the federal government out of Americans' wallets and off our backs. But he didn't just have a set of goals, he also had a plan for accomplishing them. He had a set of deeply held beliefs and fundamental principles to guide his steps. He had the ability and the desire to speak clearly and directly to the American people. While liberals uniformly underestimated and derided him as the great communicator, signifying all form and no substance, they failed to understand that his heartfelt message resonated with the overwhelming majority of the American people. Reagan also had a sense of optimism, mission, and destiny. He had a loving, devoted, an instinctually insightful wife whom he relied upon and trusted for honesty, candor, and wise counsel. And what's more, he had a great sense of humor, one that allowed him to laugh at himself and his opponents and to never be deterred or derailed from his mission. Reagan was a leader and a statesman who proved himself to be far more than just talk. He got results, and he got them in a big way. Let's take a look at his report card. He renewed the American can-do spirit and made patriotism popular again. He turned the economy around with deep across-the-board marginal tax cut rates, resulting in two decades of unprecedented prosperity. He rebuilt the U.S. military and intelligence services and increased morale in both. He defeated the Soviets and won the Cold War. He drove the communists out of Nicaragua and Grenada. He used his bully pulpit to inform and educate his fellow citizens about America's founding principles, limited government, individual liberty, and the rule of law. He spoke of God Almighty, morality, his opposition to abortion, and his support for voluntary prayer in school. He was ceaselessly proud of his country, of all it had accomplished and would accomplish. During his 1980 presidential campaign, Reagan was asked by a New York Times reporter why he thought his friend Barry Goldwater lost in 1964 in the presidential campaign. Understanding that the question was loaded, he responded, I don't think Barry Goldwater was defeated because he was a conservative. He was defeated because his opponents succeeded in creating an image of him as a dangerous radical. Tragically, for all of Newt Gingrich's strengths, many of which we should learn from and employ, the man who led stage two of the Reagan Revolution by winning control of the U.S. House in 1994 never quite fully absorbed the Reagan lesson in a way that would allow him to survive liberal demonization, though his ideas clearly did. And I say tragically because Newt Gingrich is a friend, a colleague at Fox News, and frankly, one of the smartest men ever to serve in Washington and lead the conservative movement. He is without question a brilliant political strategist. Even back in the 1970s, he had a vision of winning back control of Congress for the Republican Party. He stuck with that vision. He succeeded beyond the wildest expectations of even the most respected political experts. But along the way, he was unfairly demonized and became the favorite target of the left and the media. He was forced to retreat from the battlefield after the 1998 elections. Representative Martin Frost, a Texas liberal, who ran the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, once sent out a fundraising letter saying Speaker Gingrich, quote, promotes the policies of a terrorist. Columnist David Broder of the Washington Post called Gingrich and his Conservative Opportunity Society, a team of like-minded conservative congressmen, a bunch of bomb throwers. In December of 1995, Representative Vic Fazio, a California Democrat, said Gingrich was acting like the Grinch who stole Christmas. Time magazine even put him on the front cover as the Gingrich who stole Christmas. Day after day, no matter what he did, Newt Gingrich couldn't seem to shake the image. They trumped us with 125,000 ads coordinated with unions, paid for by trial lawyers, and paid for by the Chinese communists, he observed after leaving office. Yet remarkably, his conservative ideas were so popular and so powerful that despite the concerted effort to demonize him, the message triumphed anyway. All 10 items in the contract with America were brought to a vote in the U.S. House in the first 100 days as he promised. 9 passed the House, 6 were signed by President Clinton. Taxes were cut for the first time in 17 years. The budget was balanced for the first time since 1969. Welfare was reformed. Medicare was strengthened without raising taxes. Military spending was increased, though not nearly as much as conservatives had hoped. The missile defense research and development was at least kept on life support until a new conservative president could lead on the issue from the White House. All the while, he helped Republicans hold the House every year he was Speaker. My model was Ronald Reagan, said Gingrich, who as a California governor in 1970 proposed welfare reform at the National Governors Association. His peers voted him down 49-1. It took conservatives 26 years, but led by Gingrich, welfare reform was passed, and millions of Americans live better as a result. And that brings me to George W. Bush. During a 2000 campaign, Democrats and the liberal media treated him as stupid, shallow, unqualified, and unable to lead a great country. As with Reagan, they were wrong. I believe George W. Bush is one of the savviest and most likable presidents in recent memory. He has a set of deeply held beliefs and goals and a great team around him to help achieve them. But best of all, like Reagan, he instinctively understands the importance of the war of ideas. And that's precisely why Bush defined himself early on in his presidential campaign as a compassionate conservative. Yes, I think it's redundant, but its purpose was to send a message to voters who had been exposed to 8 years of liberal fear-mongering and falsely characterizing of Republicans, and the message, true conservatives actually are every bit as compassionate as liberals believe themselves to be. Now, despite the slimmest of margins in both the House and Senate, Bush succeeded in cutting taxes. He wanted to cut them more deeply. He wanted the tax cuts to be permanent, but he couldn't muster the votes to accomplish either. Yet he achieved what many thought was impossible, and it was no minor achievement. The entire liberal establishment in and out of Congress was dead set against him. And thanks to Bush's persistence, many believe his tax cut was just enough to help spur economic growth and end the recession earlier this year. But events changed how Bush's presidency will be measured. On September 11, 2001, not only the American people, but the people of the world found themselves looking to the new president for direction and leadership, and he provided them with both. President Bush was Churchillian in rallying our nation and allies to defeat the most dangerous threat to the free world since World War II. He led efforts at home to help those who suffered so horribly from the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and those who died in Pennsylvania. He led our military and the military of scores of other nations in the overthrow of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan, and he remains resolute in taking the war to the enemy, no matter where it hides and plots. And we've seen this war's end is not in sight. The enemy is like none other ever faced by our country. It breaks all the rules of war by refusing to identify itself as a combatant and deceptively blending in among its enemy civilian populations. It targets civilians, does not appear to fear death, and knows no borders. It seeks weapons of mass destruction in the hopes of killing as many Americans as possible, and our nation's challenge is mind-boggling, and President Bush clearly has demonstrated that he's up to the task. By the way, thank God for that. All that said, I'm an independent conservative first and a Republican second. When Republicans are right, I'll be glad to support them. But when they're wrong, when they veer away from bedrock conservative principles, I will not pull any punches. I'm not going to defend bad ideas, even if they're proposed or pursued by our own party. I'm no Republican Kool-Aid drinker. I never have been, and I never will be. Throughout the Clinton-Gore years, and particularly during the Monica Lewinsky scandal, I was always disturbed by liberals and Democratic Party loyalists who would come on either my radio show or on Hannity and Combs or any of the other shows and defend President Clinton no matter what he said or did. Didn't seem to matter to these people that Clinton lied to the country, lied under oath, harassed women, sought destruction of his political enemies, broke a myriad of laws, disgraced the office of the President of the United States, subjected America to ridicule and humiliation the world over. One after another, these liberals would just parrot the White House talking points, repeat whatever the high priest of the Democratic Party wanted them to say, no matter how indefensible. The quintessential Clinton Kool-Aid drinker, I think, is a guy by the name of Vic Camber. Now, Vic is a Democrat. He's a strategist. He's a liberal loyalist. He's stuck by the president to the bitter end. And over the years, Vic has been kind enough to appear on Hannity and Combs many times. But on one particular night, during the height of the Clinton-Lewinsky scandal, Vic came on the show, and what he said just floored me. I pointed out that Monica had just cut a deal with Ken Starr and his team of prosecutors. She was scheduled the next day to appear before the grand jury to explain her side of the story, but Vic would hear none of it. He absolutely insisted that Clinton had done nothing wrong. He insisted that Clinton had broken no laws, and he even insisted that Clinton and Lewinsky never engaged in sexual activity together, even though the evidence, including Lewinsky's own forthcoming testimony, was incontrovertible. If there's semen on the dress, Vic insisted, with a straight face, by the way, it still may not be a sexual relationship as defined by the agreement with the judge. Of all the wagon-circling moments from Clinton Democrats, in my mind, that took the prize. That, my friends, is a Kool-Aid drinker, and I'm not one of them. When I disagree with a leader in my party, I say so. When President Bush cut a miserable deal on education reform with Senator Ted Kennedy, effectively abandoning school vouchers and supporting a massive increase in federal money to and involvement in local education, I took issue with him. When President Bush abandoned his free trade principles by raising tariffs on steel imports, I took issue there. When he signed that pork-laden farm bill raising federal spending by tens of billions of dollars instead of holding the line on runaway federal spending, I took issue with him. Moreover, when he decisively established the doctrine on terrorism, you're either with us or against us, you're either fighting terrorism or you're supporting it, no one praised the president more than I. But in the spring of 2002, when he abandoned that principle in the Middle East crisis and sought to pressure Israel into holding its fire and negotiate with Yasser Arafat rather than encouraging Israel to fight and win its own war on terror, I took issue with the president. The only way for conservatives to win the war of ideas in the 21st century is to hold fast to these conservative fundamental principles, and if compromise is necessary, make sure we advance our agenda rather than the agenda of the left. We must confidently and repeatedly invoke our history, point to our record, describe our vision for the country. We must engage the left, expose their positions, contrast their positions with our own, and make our case and bring it to the American people. That's the formula for advancing the conservative agenda, even more importantly, restoring America to its founding principles and thus promoting its tradition of freedom. Have you ever stopped to think about how much the Reagan Revolution accomplished in the face of withering attacks by a hostile, biased, almost slanderous liberal media? It's amazing we got as far as we did. Conservatives fought valiantly and creatively in the 1980s to get our message out, but it wasn't easy. We had some great publications, great writers, innovative media entrepreneurs leading the way for us. We had National Review, Human Events, The American Spectator, The Wall Street Journal, editorial page, The Washington Times. We had William F. Buckley, George Will, Bob Novak, Charles Krauthammer, Cal Thomas. We had Paul Harvey, The McLaughlin Group, Jerry Falwell, The Moral Majority, Pat Robertson, The 700 Club. Beyond this, we also had a smattering of other highly gifted and impressive conservative analysts and commentators across the country. But overall, Ronald Reagan and his team of conservative policymakers in the White House, in his administration, and on Capitol Hill were more than matched by the liberal media. He had the powerful bully pulpit of the White House, occasionally addressed the nation or Congress directly, and he used his skills as the great communicator to make the most of every opportunity to inform and persuade the American people about his vision for the country. But when you think about it, there were relatively few pipelines that he could use to get his message out unfiltered because of the pervasive liberal slant of the dominant news organizations, CNN, CBS, ABC, and NBC, not to mention the bias of the reporters and editorial writers and most major newspapers and magazines. There was no Rush Limbaugh, Matt Drudge, Fox News Channel, Hannity and Combs, Ollie North, G. Gordon Liddy. There was no Dr. Laura or Dr. Dobson. There was virtually no conservative presence on talk radio. AM radio itself was slowly a dying medium and whose broadcast and cable television programs and networks were persona non grata for conservatives. Yet the Reagan Revolution triumphed. President Reagan signed into law the largest tax cuts in American history and ended double-digit inflation, interest rates, and massive unemployment. At the same time, Reagan rebuilt the United States military, won the Cold War, and freed millions of people enslaved by communism. And the American people adored him, despite the best efforts of the left to demonize him. Reagan won two landslide elections, and his popularity helped secure the presidency for the vice president. The power of Ronald Reagan's ideas, principles, and personality succeeded in overcoming what he frequently called Washington's Iron Triangle, Congress, the federal bureaucracy, and the media. Imagine how much more he could have accomplished if he'd been able to get his message out to more Americans unadulterated by the left spin and bias. On October 7, 1996, American TV news changed forever. Now, you may not remember what happened that day, but believe me, Ted Turner and the executives at Time Warner remember, for that was the day the cable news wars began and the launch of the Fox News Channel, and the day the liberal media's TV news monopoly was finally challenged. Finally, the American people were given a choice between failed and biased and fair and balanced. For decades, conservatives complained about the liberal media, and with good cause. The evidence of bias is overwhelming. Throughout this tape, I've cited examples of how conservative leaders and ideas are routinely maligned, sometimes in the most vicious of terms. That only begins to scratch the surface. Until Fox, for example, CNN was the most watched and influential cable news network in the country. It was founded by Ted Turner, a liberal loose cannon with a decidedly anti-Christian bent. Turner is called the Islamic extremist terrorist who attacked the World Trade Center brave. He called Catholics on his own staff Jesus freaks for observing Ash Wednesday. He mocked the Pope for being Polish. He said Christianity is for losers. And he compared Rupert Murdoch, founder of the Fox News Channel and Turner's chief media competitor, to Adolf Hitler. Did Turner's ideological views seep into CNN's coverage and analysis? Well, the network didn't earn its reputation as the Clinton News Network out of thin air. Now, CNN isn't alone. Brent Bozell's Media Research Center has done an outstanding job over the years of chronicling the media's broad-based liberal slant. This bias is thoroughly documented elsewhere as well, including Bernie Goldberg's amazing number one New York Times bestseller, Bias, a CBS Insider, exposes how the media distort the news, and in Ann Coulter's New York Times number one bestseller, Slander, Liberal Lies About Conservatives. Now, it's difficult to avoid the conclusion that this bias is leading directly to the demise of network news in this country. A recent article in American Journalism Review noted that the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather attracts just half the audience it did when Rather began anchoring in 1981. The NBC Nightly News with Tom Brokaw has seen its audience drop by 30% since Brokaw began anchoring in 1982. Peter Jennings on ABC's World News Tonight is doing even worse. His audience is down about 35% since he took over the anchor chair in 1983. While the big three were losing viewers, Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes entered the scene. Both have decades of experience in the media business, Murdoch as a media baron and Ailes as a political and media strategist for Richard Nixon in 1968, a general advisor, strategist, and debate coach for Ronald Reagan in the 1980 and 1984 campaigns, and a senior media advisor for George H. Walker Bush in 1988 before retiring from politics in 1991. One day they reached a simple conclusion. Rather than rail against news networks, why not create your own? From the beginning, Murdoch and Ailes realized that you don't have to create a conservative news network. You don't have to dictate, dominate, or control the content of news. Rather, the important thing is that news be reported as news, objectively, without letting undisclosed bias and editorializing seep into the cracks. Sure, Fox has opinion shows. I'm on one of them. And opinion segments and news shows. But they are clearly identified as such, and just as important, they allow both political viewpoints to be represented. In effect, Murdoch and Ailes decided to do something radical, to go back to the fundamentals of journalism by telling both sides of the story, fair and balanced. We report, you decide. Now, they're not just marketing mottos. They're a different way of doing business. This traditional approach to news was reestablished in 1996 when these two men began building the Fox News Channel from the ground up. Few in the mainstream media really thought Fox would succeed, but the network's ratings proved that there was a wide, untapped audience out there eager to hear a broader range of viewpoints and a more disciplined, hard-nosed approach to the news. Early on, the network surpassed MSNBC, the joint venture of General Electric's NBC News franchise and the deep pockets of Bill Gates' Microsoft Corporation. And later, we rushed past CNN, making Fox the number one network in the cable news industry. Now, the message couldn't have been clearer. People want news from anchormen and journalists, not liberal bias dressed up as news. They want good, smart analysis, and they aren't turned off by strong opinions from both sides, which explains why I've had the good fortune of being able to do what I do with Alan Combs each and every night on Hannity and Combs. But long before Fox brought these broader viewpoints to television, the real grassroots conservative movement had already begun, on the radio. It's hard to imagine now, but by the late 1980s, AM radio was nothing short of a dying medium. Most Americans listened to better music with greater clarity on FM radio, and the quality and creativity of news and talk programming on the AM dial was at rock bottom. Sure, there was a scattering of great stations and great personalities out there, among them people like Barry Farber and Bob Grant and Barry Gray in New York, whom I listened to avidly, but they were the exceptions. The prognosis for the industry was decidedly grim. As an analysis by the Federal Communications Commission concluded, the radio industry was in, quote, profound financial distress. Then along came a guy by the name of Rush Limbaugh, whose nationally syndicated radio show was launched in August of 1988. At first, Rush may have seemed an unlikely figure to revolutionize radio. After all, he had already been fired from 7 jobs. He was absolutely hated by the left, but he had talent, a talent for delivering his conservative commentary, not only with irreverent intelligence, but with an infectious enthusiasm that made listeners, including me, want to keep tuning in. He loved radio, and listeners loved him. Now, not everyone agreed with him, of course, but conservatives and an awful lot of liberals found themselves mesmerized. Against all conventional wisdom, Rush broadcasts his 3-hour daily radio program in the middle of the day from noon to 3 o'clock Eastern time, not during morning or afternoon drive time, long assumed to be the most listened to and lucrative time slot for talk radio. Most industry experts believed that the only thing more foolish than launching a national show on AM radio was to do so during preschool and soap opera time. Indeed, the very concept of talk radio syndication was dismissed by radio authorities as violating the immutable law that in order to succeed in talk shows, it had to be local, local, local. But Rush's success rewrote industry rules overnight. He soon had hundreds of stations signing up to be a part of the Excellence in Broadcasting Network, and before long, his show was heard on over 600 stations by some 22 million listeners a week. Now beside itself, the left set out to destroy Rush, not conspiratorially, but with a marked uniformity of purpose. They attacked him personally, publicly, and ferociously on CNN and the Washington Post, the New York Times, Newsweek, the New Yorker, the Nation, the New Republic, Time, and the Los Angeles Times, U.S. News and World Report, USA Today, on National Public Radio, at the National Organization for Women and the National Education Association. Al Gore attacked him, Al Franken attacked him, and even President Clinton joined in the hunt to demonize Rush Limbaugh. Remember Clinton's bizarre 1994 tirade on KMOX radio in St. Louis, in which he groused that Rush had 3 hours a day to speak his mind while he, as president of the United States, didn't have a way to get his message out? Yet the more the left attacked Rush, the more interest and curiosity he attracted. "Why do liberals fear me?" Rush asked in a fascinating cover story in the Policy Review magazine in September 1994. An article, by the way, in which he accurately predicted that history will remember 1994 as a watershed year in American politics, a year in which liberalism would completely melt down. "I am not a distinguished member of Congress. I'm not running for president. I do not control billions of dollars in taxpayer money. I can enact no policy, law, or regulation to affect a single American citizen's behavior. So why the high level of liberal emotion?" His conclusion? "Liberals fear me because I threaten their control of the debate." And he was exactly right. The left had never seen a conservative broadcaster so popular and so effective, and for that matter, neither had any of us. And the ripple effect was immediate. Rush's commercial and financial success, aside from his ascendant brand of common sense conservatism, soon began spawning an entire industry of new talk radio stations and hosts, the vast majority of which were coming from conservative or evangelical Christian worldview. In 1989, for example, there were only about 300 radio stations in the United States with a news talk format. But by 2001, that number had nearly quintupled to more than 1,400 stations. Ratings soared throughout conservative talk radio, and revenues soared also. Rush is now the undisputed Babe Ruth of talk radio. His most recent 9-year deal with Premier Radio Networks, a division of Clear Channel Communications, was worth an estimated $285 million, more than the combined salaries of the Big Three's anchormen. And statistics like that are a testament not just to Rush's formidable talent, but to the size, commitment, and power of the American conservative community as it finally broke through the liberal media blacklist and found a voice. Now, I'm a living testament to the talk radio tidal wave that Rush set into motion. Early in my career, Rush himself gave me a lot of breaks. He really helped me get started. He let me fill in, and it helped me tremendously in my career. But chronologically speaking, at least, my first debt of gratitude is owed to Ali North. In the late 1980s, I became captivated and infuriated with the Iran-Contra hearings and by the efforts of liberal senators and congressmen to assassinate the reputations of Marine Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, Admiral John Poindexter, President Reagan, and his entire administration. It was clear that the primary intention of these inquisitors was not to gather facts in the execution of their legitimate oversight function, but to destroy the Reagan presidency and many of the outstanding patriots who served in it. Like most people, my background and life's experience informed my judgment about people and events and so on. Like nothing before it, the Iran-Contra hearings struck a chord of discontent and urgency in me, and it was as if they were calling me to action. I was convinced that liberals were wrong about North and Reagan and Poindexter. Some forget the terrorists threatened Americans then, too, and that the Reagan administration was absolutely determined to do something about it. You should read some of Reagan's anti-terrorism speeches during the time. His words will amaze those of you who thought that this menace began with September 11th. Reagan recognized, even before George W. Bush, that at least two of the three nations designated by Bush collectively as the axis of evil were sponsors of terrorism. In a speech to the American Bar Association in 1985, Reagan said, "In 1983 alone, the CIA either confirmed or found strong evidence of Iranian involvement in 57 terrorist attacks. Our aircraft have been shot down. Our servicemen have been murdered in border incidents. And 2 years ago, four members of the South Korean cabinet were blown up in a bombing in Burma by North Korean terrorists. Now, what is not readily understood is North Korea's wider links to the international terrorist network. And Reagan was also prescient about international terrorism scope. George W. Bush was not the first president to recognize the war against terror as one of good against evil. There is a temptation to see the terrorist act as simply the erratic work of a small group of fanatics. We make this mistake at great peril, for the attacks on America, her citizens, her allies, and other democratic nations in recent years do form a pattern of terrorism that has strategic implications and political goals, and only by moving our focus from the tactical to the strategic perspective, only by identifying the pattern of terror and those behind it, can we hope to put into force a strategy to deal with it. Ollie North, decorated for courage and bravery in Vietnam with the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, two Purple Hearts, and three Navy Commendation Medals, was also keyed in to the gravity of the terrorist threat. He helped plan the Reagan administration's liberation of Grenada. He helped plan the raid against Libya in response to repeated rounds of Libyan terrorism. He helped the Reagan-Bush administration wage a relentless campaign for freedom and democracy in Central America. And for his efforts, Ali and his family were not heralded as American heroes. They were targeted, first by Libyan terrorists physically, and then by liberal Democrats politically and legally. The outrage I felt watching the left attack this man made me want to speak out and defend him. So I did what came naturally. I started calling into radio shows to express my opinion. Now, I'd grown up listening to Bob Graham, Barry Gray, John Gambling, Barry Farber, all New York radio hosts. That experience taught me early on that a passionate argument, well made, could make a difference, even if the person speaking was just a private citizen. And in a time when the liberal media was beating up on the Reagan administration daily, I quickly realized that tapping into the new phenomenon of conservative talk radio was one way I could help fight back, to defend Ollie and to take on liberals. And what happened next amazed me. The things I had to say began attracting more feedback, spurring more people to call, until sometimes I was getting a bigger response than some of the hosts I was listening to. And before long, it dawned on me that I ought to be on the other side of the microphone, as a host rather than a caller. And that's how I began seriously pursuing a career in radio. My first gig was my own talk radio show at the University of California in Santa Barbara. It didn't last long. I was actually fired in 40 on-air hours. This was a station dominated by left-wing public affairs programs, including a gay and lesbian perspective show, a Planned Parenthood show, multiple shows that accused Reagan and Bush of being drug runners and drug pushers. And the left-wing management had a zero-tolerance policy for conservative points of view, and I was promptly fired. Once my voice was silenced, my destiny was set. Do or die, I'd make my career in radio. So I put an ad in a radio trade publication and was eventually hired over the phone by WVNN in Huntsville, Alabama. Now, I don't know if the guys who ran the station fully realized the risk they were taking with me. I was practically a kid. I had almost no idea what I was doing, and I'd never done two straight hours of radio, never mind 5 days a week. At the time, I was just grateful to get my first real break, and looking back, I cringed to think what they thought of me. For starters, the cultural clash was pretty pronounced. I didn't know a single person who lived in Alabama. I had no idea where this would all end up. I was downright frightened as I packed everything I owned in the back of a van and drove cross-country chasing my dream. And when I got there, the first thing I discovered was that I had a thick New York accent. I hadn't even noticed it before. But soon, that concern all faded. Being new to the business, I always thought I was on the verge of getting fired, so out of fear, I worked like the devil just to make sure I kept my job. I tried to connect with callers. I read everything I can get my hands on, scouring newspapers and magazines. Remember, there was no internet back then, in search of stories. All I knew was I was making $19,000 a year and loved what I was doing. Well, after about 2 years, I received an offer to come to Atlanta to work at a station called WGST. A tremendous broadcaster out there by the name of Neil Bortz, who's since become a good friend, had just left the station to go to rival station WSB. But due to a non-compete clause in his contract, Bortz couldn't be on the air for a few months. That gave me the opportunity I needed. I knew if I did well in Atlanta, it could lead to even better opportunities. So I found a lawyer to negotiate a contract. It was my first. Headed to Atlanta and set out to win over Bortz's audience. Somewhere along the way, I also began appearing on television. I was horrible at it. It took me ages to feel comfortable in front of a camera, but I did it anyway to gain more exposure for my views and experience for myself. For a while, I co-hosted a TV show in Huntsville, Alabama. That was kind of a precursor to Hannity and Combs. I co-hosted with David Person, a fierce defender of the left. Then not long after I moved to Atlanta, I began getting requests to appear on national shows. I went on Phil Donahue's show, Sally Jesse Raphael's show, Geraldo Rivera's show, and Atlanta's own CNN, along with others out of Atlanta and New York. On one of those trips to New York, after taping Donahue, I stopped in to see Rush himself. Now, we'd met before over the years, but this visit to the 17th floor of 2 Penn Plaza, the home to WABC, the number one news talk station in the entire country, and the flagship station for Rush's EIB network, was an absolute thrill for a kid who'd grown up in this very city, dreaming of being on New York radio airwaves and listening to this station growing up. Little did I know that soon I'd have a chance to be on this station. On the same visit, I also met Bob Grant. He was the king of afternoon drive in New York, one of the great pioneers of talk radio in America. Bob was a hard-hitting interviewer with in-your-face opinions and one of the most entertaining hosts I'd ever heard. Early in my career, I used to emulate Bob when I was rough on callers, but I soon discovered his technique just didn't fit with my natural style. Grant was fired from WABC not long after I met him for making controversial on-air statements, and for a while, I was considered as a replacement for him until Mike Gallagher got the job. And Mike has since become a good friend, but I was still disappointed. Not long after that, though, Roger Ailes gave me my big break on Fox with Hannity and Combs, and I moved back to New York City. I also started doing radio on a fill-in basis on WABC, which soon led to an opportunity to host a weeknight show right after Hannity and Combs on WABC from 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. To my delight, my show quickly doubled in the ratings, and seemingly, in no time, WABC offered me the afternoon drive slot. The Sean Hannity Show quickly became the number one AM show in New York City in afternoon drive and the number one local talk show in New York. When a show like mine can achieve such a profile in the king of all liberal Eastern elite cities, doesn't it say volumes about the real beliefs of average working New Yorkers? As I mentioned, on Monday, September 10th of last year, the Sean Hannity Show debuted in national syndication. In just the first 7 months, we've been picked up by over 235 stations with more than 10 million listeners, and we've been heard in most of the key markets in the country, including WABC in New York, KABC in Long Island.